The first time I knew that God was real, I was in seminary. While some of you might think that's crazy, I know some of you know what I'm talking about. I was in one of my first biblical studies classes at the beginning of the first semester, and our professors are introducing the history and the context and the multiple authors, and I had to fight back the tears because all the things I knew were true in my heart and in my gut were confirmed. And standing in front of me were two of the most faithful human beings I have ever met and have still. And none of it fazed them. With them, Scripture vibrated and came alive for me. A later time, not the second, there were many times between that first and the second, and this one, I mean, God came alive again. We were studying the prophets and centering on Isaiah, and here it was, in the eye of the hurricane, was this passage, this writer, we call her Second Isaiah, and she is a revolutionary. Look at that second line again. I am the first and I am the last. Besides me, there is no God. This prophet writing in the midst of the Babylonian exile, miles and miles from home, is the first monotheist. And we all know I'm a church nerd, so it might be you might not geek out about this stuff as much as I do. But this is how I have faith today and how I can stand up here this morning. That moment. So the first incarnation of God to humanity, this God that we know in many names, was that our God was one God among many. And then God made a tribe and stuck with them, right? They didn't deserve it. Really, it was a pretty bad idea given the fallout, but whatever, right? God was committed to them. And then that God started to show how it was more powerful than all the other gods and unique among the gods, that this God had different cares, that this God had different things that God was interested in than all these other gods. God wasn't just any other God or our people's God. God was the bestest God of gods and Lord of lords, almighty. Right? And then this prophet comes along, despite all evidence to the contrary, because it sure looked like God had abandoned them and the Babylonian gods had kicked their gods' butt. Isaiah has a revelation in the middle of all that, that there are no other gods. It isn't that our God is the mightiest, it's that there isn't any other option because there is only one God. This God we now call God is it. And this revelation comes to her in the midst of despair and anxiety. They're living in a foreign land, right? The God who promised they could live at home forever has shipped them off to Babylon. The God who could only be worshipped through blood sacrifice in the temple. Well, that's done. The temple's destroyed. They need to find a new way to understand God. And God was revealed to them in a new way. Now we're plagued with the same problem today, right? With our set understanding of God and the best way and practice of worshiping Him, right? Half of it is set 1,500 years ago. Unquestioned, right? And the other 500. We get another example of this problem in Matthew. Now, if we flip back to chapter 12, we get a story which really sets up the problem we have for in the gospel passage from 13. And that chapter begins with the disciples plucking the ears off of the wheat on the Sabbath. It's a familiar enough story. They're walking through the fields and they're grabbing the ears off of the tops of the wheat, and they're just eating it like heathens. And they're just hungry. They're picking food. But the Pharisees come down hard on Jesus for this. Why? Because they classify this as harvesting. Now, if they were peeling bananas, right, that wouldn't count as work on the Sabbath. That's just peeling a banana. But snapping the ear off a stalk as you walk along in the field is harvesting. Right? Think about that charge for a second. Harvesting. Maybe that's what I should call it when my kids raid the refrigerator, right? Maybe if they do that today, at any point today, nope, you're harvesting. Then Jesus pokes the bear again, even more by healing on the Sabbath. They go from there and they go to the synagogue and there's this guy with a withered hand and he heals him. And the Pharisees are all mad again. They're trying to classify healing as work, sort it into the work bin so that they can sort Jesus into the heretic bin. So our lesson from 13 about the wheat and the weeds is directly related to this moment, because Jesus isn't talking about any old weeds. These weeds may be darnel, a kind of ryegrass, which is indecipherable from wheat. They look identical until they are fully grown, and that's when they grow a different ear. So Jesus' image isn't about leaving alone the easily discovered differences between us and pretending they don't exist, but leaving all these plants alone which look exactly alike. So this isn't a parable about bamboo sprouting amid your tomato plants. Right? These are plants whose difference is not known to you and me, not to the Pharisees or the fishermen, because the only one who knows which ones are which is the farmer who planted them. Until then, the only way we can tell the difference is when they've grown ears. Wheat, harvests, healing, Sabbath. It's all in there, so there's a lot going on here. But this is where it gets really good. We want this parable to be about how division is bad or on the one side, or else it's up to God to sort us out at the end, at the time of tribulation. But it isn't. Because the Jesus revealed throughout Matthew up to this point is constantly dividing people, and especially dividing the disciples from the Pharisees, the crowds, and even their families. Here, giving them special instruction. We skipped over the passage where he says, well, the reason I'm not telling it to them is that they are stupid. And you're not. That's my paraphrase. So Jesus knows we'll focus on the division here, even when we think we're not supposed to. That's why he has slaves ask a familiar question in the parable, right? The slaves wake up and discover these weeds in the midst, and they come to the master confused. Master, did you not sow good seed in the field? Where then do these weeds come from? They assume it must be the master's fault that there are weeds. They blame him. Who else could have done it? They blame their master when bad things happen. And then assume he'll make them dig themselves out. But the master never says any of this. It's all one big assumption. So then, given that, what does it what is it a concern to them that there are weeds at all? Why do they care? Why does it matter to them? They're assuming a whole lot about the situation, about their role. And so do we. We assume about God and our neighbors, about right and wrong, like the Pharisees longing to sort each other in boxes long before God will get the chance. And many of us also will sort ourselves into the bad box with the darnel to be burned because we don't think we're good enough. We're not waiting around to let God have a say in that. So it's time to change the script. The question Jesus gives his disciples, including us, to wrestle with is how to find God when it isn't clear, when the world would divide us and our faith would beg us to conform and worship in ways we can no longer, when we are exiled and lost and we can't tell the wheat from the darnel. Where is the truth? Who can I trust? When all looks so broken, hopeless, and there can't be a way out, God comes in a new way, saying things even the most learned scholars would call heresy. God comes to us in love and mercy and to reveal something new about the kingdom. A new thing, a new way or pattern, a new vision of love or healing. God comes and shares that the kingdom divides us because the powerful fear it and the strong will fight it and the angry will rage and rage against it because love is love without price, given without division, and across those boxes we put each other in. A kingdom with love currency and a sharing economy, a hopeful heart and a merciful mind. God will reveal the kingdom in little bite-sized pieces of love and atomic revelations which explode our hearts and expand our compassion, because that is what the kingdom looks like. That's who God is. The one God who reveals love is beyond our nature and our history and all the ways that we love to divide ourselves, who breaks the bonds and obliterates the boundaries so that we might be unbound, that we might live, that we all might live.